You'll sing a song, and I'll sing a song, and we'll sing a song together.
From You'll Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Patricia Bradford. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You're listening to Ella Jenkins. She was arguably one of the most influential and important American children's musicians of the last century. And she spent most of her life here in Illinois, in Chicago. Jenkins died just last year at the age of 100, and now she's the subject of a new biography. It's called This Is Rhythm, Ella Jenkins, Children's Music, and the Long Civil Rights Movement. The author is Gail Wald, who's a professor of American Studies at the George Washington University. She sat down with IPM and 21st Show host Brian Mackey to discuss Jenkins' life, career, and influence on children's music.
Let's start with talking about the world into which Ella Jenkins is born and raised.
Sure. Ella Jenkins was a product of the great migration of African Americans from the South to various cities all over the United States. In her case, she was born in St. Louis to parents from Alabama and Mississippi, but spent most of her life from the age of two in Chicago. She grew up on the south side of Chicago in the neighborhood then known as Bronzeville, still known as Bronzeville. It was a segregated neighborhood. It was an incredibly crowded neighborhood. There were a lot of African Americans moving in there in the first decades of the century. But it was a culturally lively place to be. And Ella Jenkins grew up hearing all kinds of sounds in that neighborhood, church sounds, secular sounds, the sounds of radio and records that would become a part of her music later on.
Yeah, this is the Black Metropolis. Some have referred to that era. And
exactly.
What is her upbringing like from a musical standpoint?
You know, Ella Jenkins grew up poor. Her mother was a domestic servant. And so she didn't have access to things like piano lessons. And for most of her childhood, Ella didn't consider herself someone who was a musician because she associated that with kids who had access to instruments and lessons. So she didn't consider herself a musician, and yet she would love to sit by her beloved Uncle Flood, who was a Mississippi migrant, who played harmonica to relax after work at the steel mills. And Ella learned the way that a lot of people learn, which is that she watched her uncle occasionally, or eventually her uncle would give her a harmonica and she would try out the harmonica. And that's how she learned. So she grew up playing harmonica, but not thinking of herself quite as a musician. That would change later on, although, you know, she really was quite self-invented. And the first music that she ever played publicly was actually African hand drums, conga drum in particular, that she took up when she was living in San Francisco in the 1940s and 1950s. It was very, very rare, exceedingly rare for a woman to be playing those drums, which were really associated with male players at that point. But that was, a lot of people know her because she went on to play and record with a baritone ukulele, kind of looks like a small guitar, but actually drums and harmonica were her first instruments.
Talk about her education, especially as it compares to other people from her, you know, who shared some of her background.
Yeah, you know, she was lucky to grow up at a time when, you know, she had a solid education through high school, and then she put herself through college. You know, I don't have to tell listeners that how unusual that was for women who were graduating high school in the 1940s. She started in junior college, and then transferred eventually to earn her degree from San Francisco State College, then it was, sociology and a new field called recreation, which I think we would think of now as a little bit like a combination of kind of recreation, but also social work. It had a kind of component of serving the community and community organizing. So she was entirely self-made. And, you know, when she came back to Chicago after getting her degree and she started making music with teenagers, She called herself a rhythm specialist. She didn't even really conceptualize herself as a children's musician because it didn't exist per se. That wasn't a job title. So she made up a title for herself called a rhythm specialist. So, which was quite audacious for someone to do, to kind of call themselves a specialist in something that, you couldn't get a degree in, but that's what she did.
Let's listen to a clip of her teaching. This is in later life. This is a workshop at Chicago's Old Town School of Folk Music, 2009. I gather this was teaching other music teachers. She's playing the harmonica. She has someone else playing a limberjack dancer, which is a small puppet on a tambourine.
I call it a limbertoy dancer, but some people call it limberjack. Okay. Sometimes when you have this, and if it's a fairly small group, pass it around for each of the children to take a turn. And it's not who has the best rhythm and who has this and that. It's that each one has a different rhythm.
All right, that video is from the Smithsonian Institution. Gailwald, talk about what that says to you about her teaching style.
Yeah, that's perfect what she says at the end to the other teachers. Pass this around. It's not about who's going to be great at it. It's about everyone having a turn and everyone having a different rhythm. That's really central to her philosophy, and it's central to the way that she imagined music as having an impact in the world. Music wasn't just about music. Music was about bringing people together, about creating communities, about learning to share, and about learning how to be comfortable with difference. Everyone sings differently. Everyone keeps time differently. But being together means learning how to be comfortable with each other's rhythms. So that was exactly, you see, it's not about, she could play virtuosically, but it wasn't about showing what she could do. It was about inviting people in.
If you're just now tuning in with us, you're listening to Dialogue. I'm Patricia Bradford, and we're checked into a conversation with 21st Show host Brian Mackey and Gailwald, the author of This Is Rhythm, Ella Jenkins, Children's Music, and the Long Civil Rights Movement.
So we talked about her education being in recreation, which is has a social work component to that. She starts out working with children. How does she begin to bring music into that work?
So music was her conduit to children rather than the other way around. When Ella returned from college back to Chicago, she got a job at the YWCA on the South Side, and her job was as teenage program director. So basically, how to keep teenagers occupied after school. And one of the things that was important to her was giving Black children tools to kind of recognize African American culture. This is in the 50s when people are not necessarily talking about African heritage. So she started a rhythm club, a Latin American rhythm club, and a percussion club and dance clubs. So she used, so by taking advantage of young people's interest in Latin rhythms. This is a time when people are interested in mambo and, early cha-cha music. And so it's dance music for kids, for teenagers. She takes advantage of that interest to kind of teach them about histories of Black diasporic music. So it's not that she went looking for children, it's that children emerged as, I think, what she saw as a kind of unserved audience.
What have you come to understand about why she was so gifted at connecting with children?
This is like the $10,000 question. I think that, and everyone who's met her, and I met her for the first time when she was 92, and in assisted living, and even 92 and in her late 90s, that charisma was there. I think that Ella never talked down to children. She wasn't afraid of children. When a child was before her, that child was a full human being. And getting to know her while I was working on this book, it became clear to me in a way I had never thought about. Well, adults, even those of us who have kids, are often just afraid of kids. We feel uncomfortable talking to them. We talk to them in exaggerated voices. Ella didn't do any of that. She got right down to a kid's level, and kids somehow knew this. They just sensed it intuitively, and that really endeared her to children.
You don't have to write, why you don't even have to phone. If you've got good credit, you can get a friendly loan. Yes, you can get yourself a friendly loan. Well, now you can get lots of cash and you can get it right away. But, buddy, you're in trouble if you miss that payment day. So stop all your worrying. You don't have to moan.
All right. The social commentary is strong there. Hopefully people can grasp the irony behind the cheerful sound. Gail Wald, what was Ella Jenkins' experience of the many challenges that came with being Black and American in the mid-20th century?
Yeah, I think one of the first questions I ever asked Ella was about traveling, because she was a traveler, a national traveler and a world traveler, and she was constantly performing over a career of 60 years or so. This particularly, before the 1970s, but even after, traveling around the country as a Black woman could be dangerous, and it could be inconvenient or more. So, for example, in the early 60s, she contracted with a group that put on school assemblies. It was called the School Assembly Service, and they provided assemblies to middle schools and high schools throughout Illinois and other states. And she would show up at a school. She was the person contracted to do the show. She would give her performance, but she wouldn't have a hotel she could stay in always. She wouldn't necessarily find a restaurant that would serve her. So, she experienced the kinds of things that actually performers in other genres, we know this from the blues women, from gospel performers. From rhythm and blues performers in the 50s, exactly the same kinds of things that they had to worry about.
This is Dialogue, and you just heard a conversation with 21st Show host Brian Mackey and Gail Wald, the author of This Is Rhythm, Ella Jenkins, Children's Music, and the Long Civil Rights Movement. Up next, Carol Moseley Braun reflects on her historic rise to the U.S. Senate in a new memoir. NPR's Michelle Martin has more.
If Carol Moseley Braun's name comes up, the other word that has to come up is first. She was the first African-American woman elected to the U.S. Senate. She was also the first female senator from Illinois and the first Black Democrat elected to the Senate. And while all those titles assured her place in the history books, they didn't assure an easy time in the job. And they certainly don't tell the story of the highs and the high cost of being the first. So Carol Moseley Braun is doing that herself in her new memoir titled Trailblazer, Perseverance in Life and Politics. And she's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Ambassador. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I'm so delighted to be with you. Good to talk with you again.
And it's Ambassador Moseley Braun because, in addition to having been a U.S. Senator and a number of other offices in politics, you were also U.S. Ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa. So you've been out of public life for a while. What made you want to tell your story now? Was there any particular thing pushing you?
You know, my little grandbaby, he's seven now. He came and said, "Grandma Carol, are you famous?" And I tried to explain it to him, but, it's too many words. And he was only six at the time. So I said, "You know what? I think that now is the time."
Why did you decide to get into elected office to begin with? Will you tell that story?
I'd been assistant United States attorney, and I had my son. And so I was here with him. I was just doing it, being a homemaker, which was fine. I really enjoyed it. But there were people in the neighborhood who were protesting the removal of the bobolinks from Jackson Park. And I joined them one day, and the bobolinks are these little rice birds, originally from South Carolina, but somehow or another they wound up here in Chicago, okay? And so some of the people with whom I was marching said, "We think you should run for state representative. Our state representative is retiring." So at first I demurred and wouldn't do it. But then after I got challenged, there's a pundit here in Chicago who said, don't run, you can't possibly win. The blacks won't vote for you because you're not part of the Chicago machine. The whites won't vote for you because you're black. And nobody's going to vote for you because you're a woman. So, and so that was my inspiration. That's what did it.
And nobody thought you could win except you.
Nobody thought I could win. And she lost all of her mind. Yeah.
But one of the things that was also interesting in the book is that so many of the jobs that you had, there was a point at which nobody believed it was you actually had that job. I mean, you tell the story right. about like being an assistant U.S. attorney and coming home from one of those cold Chicago winters, trying to get home, and you're trying to hail a taxi. This is pre-Uber, of course.
Yep.
And this police officer keeps riding by you saying, what was he saying? Get off that corner.
Give up that corner. Give up that corner.
Yep. Give up that corner. And he thought you were...
a hooker.
Because what? Why else would a black woman dressed up?
Because I was a black woman standing on the corner in downtown Chicago.
And then you talked about your first day at the Senate when you tried to get to your office. There was a Capitol Police officer who...
wouldn't let me in.
Wouldn't let exactly. you in.
Well, there are always two Capitol Police standing on the doors to the Senate. The first guy, he said, you can't go in there. I said, I looked at him like quizzically, like, why? Why can't I? Then the other guy piped in and said, oh, she's the new senator from Illinois. And so that backed his colleague off.
I don't want people to think that the entire memoir is just filled with like these insults directed at you, although there were many, like, for example, the senator who would sing Dixie in your presence and so forth.
Right.
So there's that. But there were some structural issues that you also pointed out that made your job more difficult than for other people, including, like, for example, the amount of mail that you got. Could you talk about that?
The mail was really a challenge because there was so much of it. I mean, they gave me a room in the basement of the Capitol that was filled with these duffel bags full of mail. There was no way I could possibly do all of that by myself. And so I went to leadership and I asked for assignment of some help. And one guy said to me, well, Ted Kennedy gets a lot of mail and, you know, he handles it. I'm thinking to myself, you're telling me I got to function like Ted Kennedy does? I was too outdone.
But they never gave you additional staff just to deal with
the
mail.
No, they did not.
And do you think that that played some role over the course of your tenure, the kind of angst that's sometimes built up around you, that people felt that you weren't doing the job?
It might have. But, again, you can't make everybody happy. But if you do the job, then people can't take pot shots at you.
Well, they did, though.
Yeah, they did.
Why do you think you served only one term?
Because of that. There was such expectations and people expected me to come to every chicken fry in the state and I couldn't do it. I did as much as I could, but I couldn't do all of it.
Do you think that's why? I mean, you think that at the end of the day, the expectations of you are just greater than you could as one person fulfill?
That's part of it. But I think it's also what standard you're being held to. Again, I was kind of the duckbill platypus of the Senate in the sense that I was not only a woman, but I was black, too. And I am black, too. And so you put those things together and what you have is a set of expectations that border on the unreasonable, that border on the trailblazing, the groundbreaking, if you will. And so I did my very best to live up to those expectations, but it was not always possible.
Is there anything you wish you'd done differently?
Well, not really. I did the best job I could while I was planted. I really did. And I still am. I mean, I'm not dead yet. I spoke at a high school, at a grammar school rather, and the school was named after me. And one little boy said, hey, there goes Carol Moseley Braun. And his little friend turned around and said, you mean she's not dead yet? No, she's not dead yet. So I'm still here. So while I'm still here and able to tell the story, that's why the book made sense to do.
Well, one of the things about being first is it often makes things easier for people who are next, right?
Follow.
The second
yes.
and the third and the fourth. Is there something in particular that you think made it easier for them by the fact that you went first?
Well, I hope the fact that I deflected all of the brickbats, that I don't think anybody's going to be held to the same kind of standard I was being held to in terms of, production. I hope that has really provided a roadmap to people who come afterwards. Don't get distracted with all the noise around you, because there will be lots of noise around you. But if you don't let that distract you and you just keep focusing on what the people elected you to do, you'll be fine.
That is Ambassador Carol Moseley Braun. She's the author of Trailblazer, Perseverance in Life and Politics. Ambassador Moseley Braun, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm so happy to talk to you again, Michelle.
That's all for Dialogue. Our team includes Kennedy Vincent, Ariel Ravney, and me, Patricia Bradford. The theme was composed by Lamont Holden. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are a part of Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.